This is an interview with Elaine Greenberg for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive for the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. The date is July 17th, 2014, and we're in Washington, D.C. So thanks very much for agreeing to participate in this project. I guess we usually start with a little bit of personal background. I was looking at your bio, so I guess your roots in Philadelphia are pretty deep.
Yes, indeed. I was born and raised in Philadelphia and lived in Philadelphia or in the suburbs of Philadelphia up until last year when I moved to Washington, D.C. So went to school, went to Temple University, undergraduate, Temple University Law School.
What did you do for your undergraduate?
I actually majored in anthropology.
Ah, very nice. So did you know that you were going to do law while you were doing that? Or was
no,
that
no. I think initially I was thinking I could be another Margaret Mead.
Uh-huh.
The practical aspect of making a living came into play when I was a senior. And at that point, I thought that my skill set would be well suited to the practice of law. So that's when I decided to go to law school.
Okay, so you got your BA, I see, in 82. Then did you go right on to law school after that?
I went on to law school. I started law school in 83.
Okay, at Temple there.
Yes.
Okay, tell me a little bit about that experience. Did you think about going into securities at that time? Or
Not until the spring semester of my third year. So coming down the home stretch, hadn't really found an area in particular that I would like to focus in on with respect to the law until I took a course in securities regulation that was taught by Professor Jan Pillai. And so that was in the spring of 86, I believe. And at that point, I was introduced to such wonderful statutes as Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 and Section 17A. And I thought, this is a really interesting area. I could see myself going into practice in securities regulation in that field. And that's sort of where my interest got piqued in this whole securities industry.
Do you have a notion of doing some sort of regulation all along or doing something in the government sector, or were you pretty open?
No, I mean, I thought if I'm interested in securities regulation, the first place I should begin looking would be the Securities and Exchange Commission. And as it so happened, there was an SEC office in Philadelphia, so I applied basically right out of law school, and I got hired. It was as simple as that back in the mid to late 80s. So I was very fortunate to actually be hired, and that was my first choice to go to the SEC. So that is when my career began, and I started as a staff attorney in the Philadelphia office of the SEC.
I have to ask. I talked to Kit Allman this past fall. Did you know her there?
I certainly did. We were both staff attorneys in the Philadelphia office, which was a very small office at the time. I think it consisted of just a couple branches of staff attorneys, and we were all very friendly with each other because we were such a small group. So, yes, at the time, she was known as Catherine Smith before she became Kit Adelman.
Okay, so did you start out then doing enforcement work?
That's exactly what I started out doing. And actually, I was in the Division of Enforcement throughout my entire career at the SEC.
Okay.
So that was really my home.
Tell me about some of the cases that you were working on and your role in building those cases.
Well, I started doing every sort of investigation that the SEC does. From investigating financial fraud, insider trading, market manipulation, broker-dealer fraud, investment advisor, investment company fraud, really ran the full panoply of investigations that the SEC conducts with regard to the enforcement division.
Okay, and were the cases put together then by the whole team there in the Philadelphia office, or were they divided up?
Typically each staff attorney had a docket or so of cases, and you were really responsible for conducting the investigations, reviewing documents, taking testimony. Sometimes your branch chief would be there with you, assisting you in testimony. But for the most part, as staff attorney, you really were pretty autonomous in terms of conducting the investigations. And then ultimately, when it came time to determining what to do, whether or not to pursue an enforcement action, at that point, you would begin to draft what I'm sure you've heard is the action memorandum, and that process would be more of a collaborative process together with your branch chief and others in the chain of command.
Okay. And did you were you then given that responsibility right from the beginning, or was there a sort of breaking in period?
Yeah, I really was. I was given that responsibility. I remember, a couple of the cases. It was essentially, here are boxes of documents. Here's your conference room to go sit in to go through the documents and see what you think. And, it was great for me to just come in and to, just really conduct an investigation from, the ground up. And, of course, if I had questions and didn't understand anything because I was new, there would be people there that I could consult with, both within the Philadelphia office as well as, throughout the commission. People were only a phone call away, although when I first started at the SEC, I did have to share a phone with my office mate, so that was there was a little bit of a technical challenge, but, for the most part, people were collegial and open to, getting calls from those of us out in the regions.
Sounds like a tremendous opportunity for a quick learning.
It was really an extraordinary opportunity to have that responsibility and to really try to understand and learn the securities laws.
So where would the cases from the Philadelphia branch office specifically come from?
They would come from any variety of sources, which is typical as of today. I mean, you can get a complaint from somebody from the outside of the SEC. You could read something in the newspaper that could pique your interest. Also, as regional offices, each regional office has an examination program. So there are examiners that go out and conduct exams of regulated entities, broker-dealers, investment companies, investment advisors, for example, looking at their books and records. And sometimes there are problems that they uncover, and if they're significant enough, they would refer those situations over to the Division of Enforcement, and we would then conduct an investigation as a result of a referral from the examination folks.
Regionally, was it pretty much centered on Philadelphia, or was it?
It was the Mid-Atlantic region, which covers Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, as well as the District of Columbia. So there was some overlap between the jurisdiction of the Philadelphia Regional Office and the actual headquarters of the SEC.
Was there much communication with the Division of Enforcement in D.C.?
Yes. I mean, I would say that at a certain point in time, once in the stage of an investigation, as I said before, once you get to the point where you think you may want to pursue bringing an enforcement action, you begin drafting the action memorandum that would recommend enforcement action to the commission itself. At that point, after our regional office would prepare an initial draft of the memo, it would then get sent to Washington to be reviewed by the various divisions who would have an interest in the subject matter, as well as the Office of General Counsel. And then from there, it would go on to the various councils for the commissioners, ultimately go to the commission itself. And sort of the highlights of any staff attorney's career at the SEC is that moment where the case that you've spent, a couple of years investigating gets to the commission itself for a vote. And because we were close to Washington, being in Philadelphia, we were able to, for the most part, take the train and travel to Washington and actually participate in the closed meeting session of the commission, where they would ask you questions about the enforcement recommendation. And hopefully at the end of the process, they would vote in your favor and agree that an enforcement action was warranted.
So, of course, the big things in the main division of enforcement when you arrived, you know, there was the big insider trading cases, savings and loan crisis as well.
Yes.
Did any of that have resonances in the Philadelphia office?
Sure. I mean, insider trading were, you know, those types of investigations at that time and actually continuing throughout my entire tenure. The Philadelphia office pursued many insider trading investigations and also, you know, financial type cases, financial fraud, you know, various types of you know, corporate disclosure problems. So they really were very varied in terms of the subject matter of the types of investigations that we conducted.
Did it matter as there was a switch in at the top of the enforcement division from Gary Lynch to Bill McLucas. Was there a difference in approach that you could sense at the office, the regional office level?
Well, I mean, right, you know, during my tenure at the SEC, I worked under, I believe, 8 different enforcement directors and 9 different SEC chairmen. And certainly, you know, with regard to, you know, individual, you know, preferences and ideas and also maybe what was going on generally, you know, in the industry at the time, there varied, you know, objectives and priorities and goals. And so that varied, you know, throughout the course of my entire tenure at the SEC. But for the most part, you know, if something came to our attention that was problematic and could be a possible violation of the federal securities laws, we would, you know, open an investigation and continue to investigate. So, you know, during the course of my time, I would say that, you know, priorities and you know, objectives did vary, but there were always sort of a good mix of cases, at least that I was able to investigate during those times.
So, of course, this interview is being done as part of our series on municipal securities. Could you tell me how you first became involved with the muni world?
Certainly. So my first municipal securities investigation had to do with yield burning. And that was back in the late 90s. And I was responsible for bringing the first settled yield burning action against a bank called Meridian Securities, which at the time was actually taken over by Core States Bank. So we brought the case. It was the first settled yield burning case that the commission had brought. And yield burning at the time involved a fraudulent conduct by broker dealers who would excessively mark up treasury securities in order to what was called burn down the yield. There are certain restrictions on the amount of arbitrage that can be earned with regard to municipal securities and investments, that you can't earn a higher yield on the investments than you would on the underlying bonds. And so these brokers excessively marked up treasury securities in order to, quote, burn down the yield. That was illegal. It constituted a fraud. This, you know, investigation was the result of a global investigation that was also being conducted by the Internal Revenue Service, as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. There was a key TAM action that was filed in the Southern District of New York, and the government intervened. And so the global settlement that occurred at the time, back in 1998, was a global settlement that would settle all the different government interests So core states ended up, you know, paying, you know, several million dollars in order to settle and resolve that. And what's interesting, at the time, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York that that worked on this matter was Mary Jo White, who's the current chair of the SEC. So an interesting bit of history.
So did you become specialized in municipal securities enforcement issues at that time?
Well, at that time, I would say it piqued my interest. Mm-hmm. And I thought that this area was an area that I would like to continue to be involved in. And so I always looked for opportunities to have municipal securities cases as part of my overall docket of cases from that point forward. I thought that this area was such a unique area. Municipal securities are very thinly regulated. Unlike the other securities overseen by the SEC, they're unlike corporate securities. The SEC does not have direct regulatory authority over municipal securities. They're exempt from the registration and reporting provisions of the federal securities laws. And essentially, the only tool that the SEC has is the anti-fraud provisions of the federal securities laws. But the SEC can indirectly regulate municipal securities through broker-dealers who sell municipal securities or investment advisors that may be involved in municipal securities because they do regulate those entities. But in terms of direct regulation over municipal issuers, the SEC does not have that.
Okay. So I was speaking with Paul Mako about some of these issues, and he, of course, mentioned your work, and he also said there was somebody you worked with named Mark Zahner who's not on our list of people to talk to, unfortunately. Could you tell me a little bit about him?
Sure. Well, Mark, he started at the SEC in Washington as an attorney fellow under Paul Mako. And I first became introduced to Mark as a result of these yield-burning cases. And that's when we first started to talk munis together. After his two-year stint was over in Washington, he wanted to transfer to the Philadelphia office. He's actually from Philadelphia, so during the 2 years that he was working in D.C., actually commuted from D.C. from Philadelphia to D.C. So as an attorney fellow, you have a two-year commitment. So after that, he came to work for the Philadelphia office. And, you know, from that point forward, we worked together and we, you know, brought municipal securities cases together. And, you know, we looked to bring, you know, cases that would have impact on the industry. And eventually that led to the formation of the Specialized Unit for Municipal Securities and Public Pensions.
That was in 2010?
Exactly.
Okay. So we'll try not to get to the end
not
of the
to
interview
not get
too quickly. One of the other things that Paul was telling us is that they were trying to use enforcement cases to sort of tell a legal story, and I guess in a certain sense to clarify SEC's policy, especially on the applicability of the anti-fraud provisions. Was that something that was perceptible at where you were coming from?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was the whole reason for pursuing enforcement action, because the SEC had such limited authority, as I said, to regulate this industry, that the vehicle through which the SEC's views on what was acceptable conduct in the markets many times were brought out through the enforcement actions.
Mm-hmm. And were the going back to the Yulebrand cases, were those primarily done out of your office, or were they out of Washington? I mean, how was that divvied up?
The first yield-burning case was brought out of the Philadelphia office.
Okay.
That was the settlement that I talked about with Meridian Securities / Core States. After that, that case actually served as the model for global resolution of the yield-burning cases that came after that. And then, so there were, after Meridian, there were several other yield-burning actions that were brought, mostly coordinated out of Washington.
And how do you build a yield-burning case? I mean, how do you establish... I guess that the markups were actually quite extraordinary, so I suppose there was a fair amount of obviousness there, but maybe you could bring me through the process.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, any of these sorts of cases and investigations require both, you know, the investigation of the facts to determine what happened. So, like any, you know, enforcement investigation, you look at documents, you take sworn testimony, you... try to determine, you know, who knew what, who did what, and just kind of get a baseline of what the facts are. Then you have to perform the legal analysis, apply the law to the facts, and try to make a determination whether or not the federal securities laws were in fact violated. And so with most municipal securities cases that I was involved in, most of them were cases of first impression. They were novel issues. They were, you know, situations where the SEC had never brought an action in this area before. So, you know, a lot of the case law we were developing, and, you know, which was an extraordinary opportunity, you know, as a lawyer, mm-hmm. to be part of that effort to, you know, develop the case law and to bring cases of first impression. And, you know, of course, they had to be legally sound and have a basis for, you know, applying the law to the facts. But the anti-fraud provisions are fairly broad, intentionally. Materiality isn't defined, for example. And so there is a latitude to be able to look at novel fact patterns, novel situations, instances where there was really no precedent, and be able to apply a lawyerly analysis to determine that there were, in fact, violations of the federal securities laws.
In establishing the facts of the case, was the legendary opacity of the muni market at all a barrier? Of course, the treasuries are the things that are being marked up, so maybe that doesn't apply, but I'll leave that to you to tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I think with regard to, you know, many of the investigations, not just the yield-burning cases, the lack of transparency, as you said, the opacity of the market, you know, we were in the position of trying to pierce through that, to try to determine, you know, exactly how, you know, the markups occurred, what exactly was the thinking behind it, you know, were these individuals intentionally committing fraud? What were the, you know, different, you know, markups, and were they in fact excessive? And, you know, looking at, you know, the full range of conduct, did it give rise to a violation of the federal securities laws? And, you know, I would say it wasn't just the yield-burning cases, but, you know, most of the cases that I ended up investigating in the municipal securities space, you know, you had to really, you know, figure out what exactly was going on, trying to uncover the facts, and, you know, determine, you know, do you have sufficient evidence to prove up a violation of typically the anti-fraud provisions of the federal securities laws.
How quickly did it become apparent that yield burning was a fairly widespread practice within the industry?
Well, it was interesting because, as I said, there was a key TAM case that was filed by Michael Lisak, who himself had engaged in the yield burning. And, you know, as part of his key TAM action, he was in the position of cooperating with the federal government to demonstrate that there was, in fact, a violation going on. So, you know, that was part of, you know, his effort working with the U.S. Attorney's Office to demonstrate that this, in fact, was a widespread scandal that was occurring at the time.
When it comes to the New York banks that were partaking in this, was that handled out of your office, or was that the New York office, or D.C.? Yeah.
I think D.C. was really the one that coordinated the effort with the other banks and, you know, the resolution that occurred thereafter. You know, as we're talking about yield burning and the big banks, so, you know, years later, yield burning two, as I like to refer to it, occurred, where there were the bid rigging cases that were actually brought out of the Philadelphia office, as well as part of the effort of the unit that was formed. And we can maybe talk about that when we get to the formation of the unit, but it's interesting to observe that the yield burning, you know, cases that were brought back in the late 90s, you know, years later, there ended up being sort of another scandal that entailed, you know, these violations of Treasury regulations and bidding for securities. In that context, in the later context, it was guaranteed investment contracts. It wasn't Treasury securities, but it had to do with reinvestment of escrow proceeds. So it was similar in that, you know, it was, you're still dealing with, you know, arbitrage, impermissible arbitrage, jeopardizing the tax-exempt status of the bond. So it was similar in that respect.
Tell me a little bit, at the SEC, how the Office of Municipal Securities and the Division of Enforcement managed to build up this area.
Well, so the Office of Municipal Securities was formed, you know, Paul Mako, he was the head of that Office of Municipal Securities back in the in the late 90s. Arthur Levitt was the chairman at the time. His priority was, you know, to investigate municipal securities cases. So the Office of Municipal Securities was created. Paul Mako was the head of it. Enforcement, you know, we were trying to look for instances where we could be successful in bringing enforcement actions that would send a message to the market. And so over the course of, you know, the years, you know, we identified situations where that they would be message cases and that the market would take note and appreciate that, you know, although municipal securities are underregulated and in fact not directly regulated by the SEC, that the SEC still has an interest to ensure that investors of municipal securities are afforded whatever protections that can be had under the law and under the limitations of the law. And, you know, unlike corporate securities, which are directly regulated by the SEC, municipal securities are not. But yet, if there's a fraud that's going on, you know, the SEC can step in and hold those accountable who committed the fraud, thereby, you know, hopefully protecting the investors in the municipal securities.
In terms of the enforcement cases that you're able to bring, what was the balance like between the dealer end and the issuer end?
Well, I would say that, you know, fast forwarding into, you know, the future, you know, given the SEC's mandate of investor, you know, protection, you know, it's interesting because sometimes the municipal issuer is in the role of investor, as it was, you know, with regard to the yield burning and the bid rigging cases, because, you know, these are products that the, you know, issuers are buying, whether they're Treasury securities or GICs or some other reinvestment product. So in that case, the municipality is in the role of investor and was victimized, essentially, as was the federal government, because, you know, the IRS, you know, or the, you know, Treasury Department, you know, was the victim there because the arbitrage rules were violated. And so, you know, in other situations, you know, the municipal issuers are the ones that are issuing securities, and they may make misstatements in their offering documents, which are going to investors, and the SEC obviously has an interest in protecting investors, whether or not they're retail investors, whether or not, you know, they take the form of municipal entity investors. So I would say, you know, the mix was really split, you know, between the two. And so when you have dealers that are, you know, committing fraud, you know, that could be against municipality, it could be against investors. On the other hand, municipal issuers can themselves also engage in fraudulent misconduct through offering documents that may be materially misleading.
Now, on the dealer end, of course, there are more rules, but they're from the MSRB, and those are mainly enforced by what was then the NASD. Did you have a good view of those activities at the time and an ability to judge how much enforcement was going on that side of things?
Yeah, I would say that the SEC and the former NASD, which became FINRA, those are the only two agencies that can enforce the MSRB rules, as you know. The MSRB is the rulemaking authority, and then the SEC or FINRA can enforce them. But the SEC has brought and continues to bring cases based upon violations of the MSRB rules. I mean, in particular, I would say Rule G37, is a rule that the SEC has brought enforcement actions over the years, continues to have an interest in pursuing those actions. G17, the SEC has brought, you know, numerous cases with regard to that provision. So I would say that it really wasn't only the NASD, now FINRA, that has pursued actions for violations of the MSRB rules. The SEC has also done that and really shares the concern, and that is a priority of the SEC as well. So it's not just the anti-fraud, you know, violations. It's also violations of the MSRB that the SEC pursues as well. And again, that's more of the direct regulation of the regulated entities, the dealers, in this instance.
What was the perception of how vigorously the MSRB rules were being enforced prior to, this may be a bit prior to your engagement with it, but prior to the SEC really, and Arthur Levitt in particular, stepping up focus on this area?
Yeah, I would say that, I mean, overall, there wasn't much of a focus on it. I think that you had a few people that maybe were concerned about the area, but you know, for the most part, people's priorities and focuses were elsewhere. And I think it really had to come to light the effect that municipal securities has really on investors in general. And I think over time, there became more of an appreciation for, you know, who these investors were. And it's a heavily retail investor base. Two-thirds of municipal securities are held by retail investors, a third directly by them, another third through mutual funds. So when you look at the SEC's mandate of investor protection, you combine that with a heavily retail base in a particular type of security, you can see why, you know, over time the SEC, I believe, became concerned about what type of protection there was going to be for those investors in light of the, you know, regulatory framework and the limitations on the SEC's ability to directly regulate municipal securities.
You mentioned G37. Could we talk a little bit about how pay-to-play cases work?
How pay-to-play cases work? Well, if you look at what the requirements are of G37, and there's certain limitations on political, you know, contributions and when you can obtain, you know, underwriting business, for example, and it's really looking at and investigating whether or not you have situations where there were contributions being made and business was then obtained or underwriting business was obtained within a two-year time period. An interesting case that was brought when I was chief of the Municipal Securities Unit was the case against Goldman Sachs, which was just a pure G37 case. There was no allegation or no findings of violations of the anti-fraud provision. So it was just a pure G37 case And that case involved a situation where there wasn't a, I mean, there was a direct cash contribution, but there was a component that was indirect as well, and that stood for, you know, the case ended up really being the first time that the SEC brought an action for non-cash, what was called in-kind contributions, and that was found to, you know, also be a violation of G37.
What is it exactly that would trigger a violation of MSRB rules to go to the SEC rather than an ASD?
You know, the SEC and FINRA, you know, they do sort of coordinate, mm-hmm. and sometimes both can bring actions, both have the authority. And it's really, you know, a situation where, you know, is a course of conduct so problematic that really, you know, the SEC has an interest in bringing an enforcement action and sending a message through that. But, you know, FINRA, you know, they you know, bring many cases for violations of MSRB rules. And so I think it's really, you know, a coordination effort, you know, looking at, you know, which cases should FINRA bring, which cases should the SEC bring. And that's really, I think, how it works.
Could you tell me a little bit about the development of the law concerning issuer disclosure and the vexed issue of exactly what constitutes proper disclosure?
Sure. So the SEC has an interest in, you know, ensuring that disclosure in primary offering documents is accurate and complete and doesn't contain any any misrepresentations or omissions that would be material to investors, but also that once municipal bonds are issued, that, you know, these bonds could be out there for 30 years. And so the concept of continuing disclosure is really also very important to the SEC. And as I said, because the SEC doesn't directly regulate municipal issuers, the basis for looking at whether or not disclosure is adequate is looking at what's contained in the official statement for the most part and seeing whether or not there are any misrepresentations or omissions of material fact in those for primary offerings. For continuing disclosure in secondary market disclosure, the SEC indirectly regulates that through Rule 15c212, which is a rule that requires, you know, underwriters to ensure that that municipal issuers are complying with continuing disclosure undertakings, which essentially is a contract that the municipal issuer enters into on behalf of investors to ensure that they provide up-to-date financial information, for example, on an annual basis. And so in order for an underwriter to satisfy themselves that the issuer has complied with these contractual continuing disclosure undertakings, it has to engage in due diligence and have a reasonable basis for ensuring that the issuer has, in fact, complied with those undertakings.
Could you tell me a little bit about this is, again, getting up close to the present, but
yeah.
The Harrisburg case, I think, introduced an interesting wrinkle into this whole area, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, the Harrisburg case, you know, that situation was one where, you know, that was, again, another case of first impression. And that was the first time that the SEC ever charged a municipality for misleading statements made outside of its securities disclosure documents. And so Harrisburg failed to comply with its contractual undertakings to provide continuing disclosure. So there was a dearth of information in the market regarding what the financial condition of Harrisburg was. So the SEC looked at various statements that it was making outside of its, you know, typical securities disclosure documents, such as its budget report, financial statements, as well as a state of the city address that its mayor was making. And in those documents, the SEC determined that there were material misrepresentations and omissions being made about the financial condition of Harrisburg, such that they, constituted violations of Section 10B and Rule 10b-5, and ended up bringing an enforcement action against against the city of Harrisburg. There was a companion 21A report that the SEC brought at the time, at the same time, which also cautioned public officials to essentially be mindful and pay attention to their obligations under the federal securities laws, because they too could be, the subject of an enforcement action if they don't understand, appreciate, or involved in, misrepresentations and omissions that could be material to investors.
Are these oftentimes cases of recklessness versus intent to defraud? I'm not talking about Harrisburg in specific, but...
It varies. I mean, the SEC takes the position that in order to meet its burden under Section 10B, recklessness is sufficient. So either intentional or reckless conduct would be sufficient for establishing scienter for Section 10B. Other cases, Harrisburg is not one of them, but in other situations, the SEC has just brought enforcement actions for violations of Section 17A, specifically Section 17A2 or 3, which only require a showing of negligence. With regard to which anti-fraud provisions the SEC utilizes or has utilized over the past, it has used all of them. Whether or not the state of mind requirement is intent, reckless, or negligent, the SEC could pursue and has pursued actions with regard to all those provisions.
It seems like something that would apply in particular to the muni market, given the variety of issuers that there are. And, my knowledge of the cases isn't encyclopedic, but it seems to me that mainly the cases have been brought against larger issuers, cities, Miami, San Diego, Harrisburg, and so forth. But is that a misperception?
I would say that it really does vary, and that the SEC has brought cases in the past against smaller issuers, and I think recently, since I've left the SEC, a case was brought against Wenatchee, which I think is a smaller issuer in the state of Washington. Other situations that the SEC has brought. When I was there, we brought a case against Dauphin County, and even the city of Harrisburg. Even though it is the capital city, it's not really that large.
It's not New York. Yeah.
It's not really that large of a city. So I would say it really, over the years has varied in terms of the actions that are brought in, and it's really as we get the facts and we, may have an indication of a violation. I mean, at some point, it doesn't necessarily matter how large the issuer is if, in fact, there is a violation of the federal securities laws and it's significant enough that warrants an SEC action, then we would pursue it. Irregardless of the size of the issuer.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the length of time that it can take to develop these cases. One of the things that I mentioned to Paul Mako is that I was startled when I actually looked into it how long the Miami case took to develop. I knew that it was that the enforcement action came in, when was it? 2003 or something like that?
Well, there were two.
There's the most recent one as well, Miami
right.
Part 2. But it took over 5 years, I think. And he said that actually Miami was the first one to fight back. I don't know if you had anything to do with that case.
I didn't. I was not involved in the city of Miami case. But just generally speaking, I mean, for the most part, these are complicated cases. Many investigations that the SEC brings, not only in the municipal securities area, are complex, and it does take time to conduct investigations to make sure that we have it right. you know, the SEC goes through a really rigorous process in order to, you know, make sure that we have all the facts that, that we need, both good and ones that maybe wouldn't be so good from an enforcement perspective. But it's important to know, you know, is there a risk that the SEC wouldn't prevail? All of that needs to be explained to the commission, you know, before it, you know, takes a vote on whether or not to, you know, pursue an enforcement action. So the complex cases do take time, and you know, it is a large effort and can be very, very difficult. And with regard to the municipal securities area, again, because it's so lightly regulated, that can add to the length of time as well. Mm-hmm. There are no requirements that, you know, municipalities have to maintain, for example, books, records, or anything, or that they, you know, comply with any disclosure standards. And with regard to, you know, financial statements, there's no federally mandated accounting standards, for example, that municipalities have to comply with. So, you know, many times it's difficult to determine whether or not there's been an actual violation of the federal securities laws, because it's not as simple as looking at a line item, you know, for example, on a corporate financial statement and saying, oh, well, this item was inflated, or this didn't comply with GAAP, you know, and so it's sometimes very difficult to sort through all of the facts and then to apply the analysis to make sure that there is, in fact, a violation of the federal securities laws.
Well, let me come back to pay-to-play. Of course, the original G-37 referred to the dealers, but in more recent years, that's been applied to municipal advisors. Of course, consultants were banned altogether. How has that developed from the enforcement side?
Well, it's interesting. Today is actually the fourth anniversary of the passage of Dodd-Frank. So I saw an announcement, a press release today from Chair Mary Jo White, and so she talks about, you know, today is the fourth anniversary of the Dodd-Frank Act, and one of the things that she notes is how you know, the act created a new regulatory framework for municipal advisors. And so the Dodd-Frank Act, even though it was 4 years ago, required that the SEC develop rules for municipal advisors for their regulation and registration. And that rule went into effect on July 1st, 16 days ago. And so basically there's a fiduciary standard that municipal advisors have to comply with. They have to treat their municipal clients, you know, with the highest degree of care. And, you know, with regard to the application of MSRB rules, those are still a work in progress. So right now the MSRB is in the process of drafting MSRB rules that would apply to newly regulated municipal advisors. And so there are draft rules out there now that are out for comment. One is on the fiduciary duty standard. Another one is on supervision. The next one, I believe, that the MSRB is going to be putting forth in draft form will probably be the pay-to-play rule. So, you know, it's a work in progress, and municipal advisors are now, you know, subject to regulation. Never had been before. And so this is really a very significant step in terms of, you know, regulation of the market. And in the past, you know, municipal advisors, sometimes, you know, they were the subject of investigations and even enforcement activity by the SEC, but they were unregulated. And there was no standard that really, you know, to which they were held to. And so now with, you know, the passage of Dodd-Frank and the SEC having a rule in place, they now will be subject to regulation and oversight by the SEC. So it is a very significant development in the history of municipal securities.
Well, let me ask about some of the products associated with municipal bonds. Kit Taylor was saying that, in his opinion, interest rate swaps were the real sequel or the immediate sequel to yield-burning cases in terms of overpricing to municipalities and that sort of thing. Of course, there's the auction rate securities as well. There's the whole issue around the regulation of derivatives, but I feel like I'm putting too many different things together, so I'll just let you.
Well, what's interesting about the municipal securities marketplace is because it's, for the most part, very lightly regulated. It has been fertile ground for the development of new financial products. So many times you will see new financial products arising for the first time in the market as a result of coming out of the municipal marketplace, because it's more or less a testing ground for the market, because it's not, that they aren't really highly regulated. And so that's why you see, you know, many times these products that are coming out, and which, you know, on the one hand, I think in terms of innovation for the market and you know, one of the SEC's other, you know, mandates is, you know, capital formation. And so, you know, if you look at it from that respect, if I take off my, you know, enforcement hat and look at it as, you know, encouraging innovation in the market, coming up with new products, I mean, all that is good. I mean, assuming that people play by the rules and that there's a level playing field, you know, that's all a good thing. It's when, you know, folks take advantage of, you know, the lack of oversight, the lack of regulation, and, you know, begin to, you know, do things that are, in the worst case scenario, an out-and-out fraud, less or so, you know, ones that really are not so much in the best interest of their customers or clients.
Yeah, it seems that most of the enforcement, again, with a very outsider's view, that's come in the marketing of these sorts of products. That's certainly the case in auction rate securities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of times I think what happens is that, especially with products that are more complex, you have brokers or dealers out there that are marketing these as investments to their customers without perhaps disclosing the risks entailed in these products. Sometimes the dealers or the brokers don't even understand them themselves. I was involved in, you know, investigations where the brokers who were selling these products didn't really even appreciate what they were, what the risks were, and, you know, really didn't, weren't even in a position to disclose anything to investors because they hadn't even, you know, conducted due diligence on their own behalf to figure out what these products entailed. So a lot of, you know, the problems that have arisen in the past are a result of either, you know, brokers themselves not understanding the products or understanding the products and then choosing not to disclose the risk to their customers because they just want to sell the products and get their commission or fee on it.
Could you tell me about the role of public pension funds in all of this? Of course, it's named specifically in the special unit that comes up, so there must be a backstory here to be told.
Well, you know, maybe do you want to talk about the formation of the specialized unit at this point, or
whichever seems logical to do? I mean, if that's a good lead-in to talking about pensions.
I think so. You know, I think that you know, the specialized unit was created in 2010, as well as other, you know, four other units were created by the Division of Enforcement in order to, you know, have units that were devoted to, you know, complex products or, you know, complexities that existed in the marketplace and to better appreciate and understand, you know, what was going on. And so the Municipal Securities and Public Pensions Unit was created because, as we've been talking about, there's, you know, opacity in the market.
Can I clarify straight off that I know, of course, this is around the same time that the Office of Municipal Securities is made independent again, and that had to do with Dodd-Frank. This is not related to that at all?
No, I mean, I would say that in 2009, so that's prior to Dodd-Frank. The SEC Division of Enforcement went through a self-assessment, went through a major restructuring, and among other things, created specialized units. Also determined that that there should be one less level of management. So branch chiefs, that position was eliminated. The first supervisory position was then an assistant director, beginning in, at the end of 2009, going into 2010. So the units were created to, you know, address in some respect some of the criticism that the SEC had been getting in sort of the post Madoff, post-financial crisis world. And it was a way for, you know, the Division of Enforcement to really, you know, give a self-assessment and figure out, is there a way that we can, you know, address, you know, these concerns, and to better position ourselves to be smarter about, you know, how we go about our business. And so these units were created with that in mind. And so I was appointed as the first chief of the Municipal Securities and Public Pensions Unit. And so the area of public pensions, was one of concern, and it is related to municipal securities in that, you know, municipalities, one of their largest liabilities are funding of their public pensions. And so because these represent huge liabilities for municipalities, the SEC has an interest in ensuring that when a municipality goes to market and conducts a bond offering, that it's disclosing, the degree of funding or underfunding of public pension funds. So investors that are going to be investing in the bonds of a municipality and or state have a full appreciation of what the financials are with regard to these huge liabilities. And so that's why public pensions are really part of the mandate of the unit to ensure that what are these huge liabilities, you know, are adequately disclosed to investors, so that investors have full information. So that's why public pensions is part of the title of municipal securities and public pensions.
Okay. I think we reserved our discussion of bid rigging until this particular moment. So should we return to that?
Oh, the bid rigging. I'll talk about, the unit. For me, to go about forming this unit, it was really, go forth and create a unit. And because, many people in the SEC really didn't have any background or understanding of municipal securities, a lot of this was an educational effort and a training effort. And so my deputy, Mark Zahner, and I, so he became deputy of the unit, we traveled to every SEC office around the country to talk to the staff about municipal securities.
And the unit was run out of Philadelphia.
It was run out of, because Mark and I were based in Philadelphia,
right.
So it really didn't, that's why it was based out of Philadelphia. But we ended up having staff in 10 of the SEC offices, including in Washington. And so, the first thing that we set about doing was to train everyone. And we had a Muni boot camp that we held for everyone in Philadelphia. And for the most part, the unit was comprised of staff attorneys and assistant directors who were their supervisors, and many of whom had never brought a case in the municipal securities area. So we really had to have basic training for them. In addition, we determined to hire specialists from the outside. That was really a critical part of the unit, so that they could bring their expertise in-house. So we ended up hiring a former investment banker, a former trader, and then later someone who was a former finance director of a major city who had extensive experience and knowledge with regard to governmental accounting standards, which is known as GASB as opposed to FASB, which is what governs the corporate world. So a totally different accounting methodology and standards are at work with regard to municipal securities. So we had to make sure that we we, you know, had staff internal that, you know, were capable of, you know, assisting staff attorneys and supervisors conducting investigations and fielding questions that, that they would have as issues would arise that are, you know, very substantive in nature.
Did it make that difference to have, I know Elise Walter, of course, is active in this area. Was it helpful to have her being a commissioner during this period?
Absolutely. She actually was an honorary guest at our boot camp. So it was really tremendous that you know, she had, you know, such an interest in municipal securities. And in fact, you know, the whole effort with the field hearings, the municipal securities field hearings that were conducted over the course of 2 years from 2010 to 2012, and then ultimately resulted in a 150-page report on the municipal securities market. You know, our unit was involved. I was involved with that effort, both in terms of, you know, participating in the various field hearing effort, as well as drafting parts of that report. So Commissioner Walter was the driving force behind that. So, you know, absolutely, it was a very rewarding experience to be able to be involved with her in leading the charge on the municipal securities front.
Did we cover bid rigging to our satisfaction, or did we get distracted?
Yeah, well, I would just say bid rigging was yeah. You know, one of a number you know of cases that we brought in the unit. You know, it was, as I viewed it, as, you know, yield burning too. So we ended up bringing settled enforcement actions against five major financial institutions. Mm-hmm. You know, for their roles in, you know, what was this very complex, wide-ranging bid rigging schemes, which involved the reinvestment of bond proceeds and such, you know, investments as guaranteed investment contracts and other products. And, you know, collectively, as a result of those settled actions, I think the total settlement between the SEC, the IRS, the Department of Justice's Antitrust Division, and a coalition of 26 different state attorney general's office, I think, resulted in settlements along the lines of, I think, $745 million, all of which, or most of which, was distributed back to the municipalities that were harmed as a result of these schemes.
When we talk about these schemes, either yield burning or bid rigging or anything else, where in, say, a big bank, how much of a bank is typically involved in that sort of thing, for example? Is it a small group of people? Would it be an entire muni desk? Would it be more systematic? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it would be, clearly it would be from the municipal securities desk. And you know, it really depended on the bank in terms of how widespread it was, but certainly, you know, enough so that it really, you know, impacted how they were engaging in the business and engaging in, you know, bid rigging with, you know, other banks, with the bidding agents, et cetera. So, you know, I think it really varied. But it was, you know, for the most part, I would say, housed within, you know, the muni desks mm-hmm. of these various banks.
I had the opportunity to interview David Clapp of Goldman Sachs. Of course, he retired in 1994. And I was struck that he didn't, whether sincerely or not, I don't know, didn't seem to have much knowledge of the practice of yield burning. So I was kind of curious as to exactly... I won't ask you to comment on that in particular. One, you wouldn't know about those earlier... Well, you might.
For the earlier cases.
For the earlier yield burning cases.
Yeah.
No, so... I'll move on. So I was looking actually at the statement that the SEC released when you left the SEC last year. And of course, they list a number of cases that you were able to bring as part of this special unit. So maybe you could talk about what you view as the key accomplishments during your three, four years as the head of that unit.
Yes, well, I think, well, you know, we talked about the bid rigging cases. That was a significant accomplishment. We talked about Harrisburg. That was, you know, a case of first impression. Also, I think the case against the state of New Jersey, that had to do with misrepresentations and omissions in connection with the sale of over $26 billion worth of municipal bonds, where the SEC found that New Jersey fraudulently misrepresented and omitted to disclose material information regarding its underfunding of its two of its main pension funds. And so that was the first time that the SEC ever brought an enforcement action against any state for anything. So that was really a case of first impression in terms of you know, looking at the history of the SEC and how the SEC had never before sued a state for any sort of you know, misconduct, and so that I think was a very significant action that we brought, that the unit ended up bringing. And then that was followed on by action against the state of Illinois, again, for, you know, misrepresenting its the adequacy of its plan to fund its pensions. That was brought in March of 2013. That, I think, was also, you know, a very significant case as well. And again, as I said before, the whole area of public pensions and the funding or not funding of public pensions is one where not only the SEC has sort of an interest in that area, but, you know, others, you know, have also been focused in on that particular problem. And I remember, you know, being involved in the FSOC, the Financial Stability Oversight Council report back in 2013, their annual report actually highlighted the case that the SEC brought against the state of Illinois as being, you know, something that should be looked at and considered in terms of a systemic risk that, you know, other states or municipalities out there can, you know, be the subject of significant financial stress as a result of pension fund liabilities that they have, and witness, you know, the city of Detroit, which, you know, filed for bankruptcy in part because of huge pension liabilities that were outstanding that it owed to pensioners. So, you know, the whole area of pension fund liabilities, what is owed to pension funds, I mean, what is owed to pensioners, how, you know, they get funded, and what is ultimately disclosed to investors, which is what the SEC cares about, is really, you know, an area that has, you know, garnered widespread concern and attention both within the SEC and outside the SEC.
Okay. We've been talking about municipal securities for quite some time, and I don't want to give the impression that that one is necessarily all that you're doing over this entire period. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about the balance between this specialty and the rest of your work.
Okay, sure. Well, so during at least the last 3.5 years that I was serving as chief of the Municipal Securities and Public Pensions Unit, I was also serving in another senior officer role as being associate director for enforcement for the Philadelphia office. And my time was split 50-50 between both roles. And in as associate director, I was overseeing the enforcement program for the Mid-Atlantic region of the SEC. And, you know, brought numerous cases, you know, in the area of, you know, corporate issuer disclosure, financial and accounting fraud. One of the last cases that I ended up bringing in the area of corporate issuer disclosure was a case that we brought against BP. back in November of 2012. The SEC pursued an action against the global oil and gas company and charged it with fraudulently misleading investors while its Deepwater Horizon rig was spilling oil into the Gulf of Mexico by significantly understating the flow rate in various reports that were filed with the SEC. So that was a fairly significant action that I supervised and ended up resulting, I believe, in the payment of the third largest penalty at $525 million in SEC history. And there was also a parallel action brought by the Department of Justice's Deepwater Horizon Task Force. So that was a fairly significant action that was brought in that area.
How was that? How did that come to the Philadelphia office?
It was just something that we looked into and determined to open an investigation on.
Is BP in America situated in that area, or is it?
Nope.
Oh no,
it wasn't. It was just something. I mean, that was, you know, what I'll have to say about you know, my work at the SEC over the years is that it really evolved from being work that was maybe focused in on a regional basis to one that was really more of a national practice. And I think it was a result of, you know, really looking at who at the SEC, say in the Division of Enforcement, had the expertise, had, you know, the specialization, really understood the issues, that, you know, you could really pursue any investigation no matter where, you know, it would be based. And so, you know, for example, there were many insider trading cases that we brought that were not based in Philadelphia, but could be based in California, could be based in New York. So, you know, BP obviously is not headquartered in Philadelphia, but, you know, over time, you know, we brought cases that were not based within the four corners of the regional offices, you know, Mid-Atlantic area. And so I think that was something that grew over time and that the office really became one that, you know, had a national practice, I would say, versus just a strictly regional practice.
Are there any overarching trends in enforcement that you could point us to that are of particular interest, whether in enforcement policy or things that you have to enforce against?
Well, I do think that the whole specialization effort was really key to how the enforcement division goes about its work. And again, it was sort of in line with what I was saying about looking at people's expertise and capabilities as opposed to just being locked into, you know, where they are in the country and that certain cases should be brought, you know, in certain particular offices because that's where, you know, the conduct is. I mean, that still happens. Obviously, it's still, you know, is could be looked at as the bread and butter of, you know, a lot of the regional offices. But you know, and sometimes in the more complex cases, you're going to look at people who have the expertise, the understanding, to actually be successful in pursuing these types of enforcement actions. So I think that was all part of, you know, the view of specialization was, you know, go and you know, develop expertise in these areas, and then you're going to be better able to, you know, be successful in pursuing these investigations, which are often complex, and you need to really understand what the issues and the complexities are.
Did your work track some of the other trends that were happening in enforcement, such as all the corporate cases after 2002 Enron, of course, et cetera?
Well, I mean, you know, we had our range of cases that we brought. You know, there were, you know, financial fraud cases. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, again, insider trading cases. You know, we had our, you know, referrals from our examination program. So those were regulated entity cases against broker dealers, investment advisors, or investment companies. And so, as I would say, I mean, it really ran the full gamut of the types of investigations that you would contemplate the SEC, you know, being able to you know, conduct investigations of.
There wasn't really a waxing and a waning of certain kinds of cases over time.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I would say, you know, when I look through, you know, the history of the cases that I've brought, I mean, there were certain you know, times, just, you know, for example, you mentioned auction rate securities. Yes, so, you know, people were focused in on bringing the auction rate securities cases, and that was, you know, something that we focused in on, you know, during a limited period of time. But I think, you know, for the most part, looking at broker-dealer practices, investment advisor practices, insider trading, you know, corporate disclosure, you know, and fraud, I mean, I think for the most part, you know, over the years, there were some of all those types of cases within the full docket, you know, of what we were investigating. Not to, you know, also forget, you know, market manipulation. You know, that was also a large part. And I would say, you know, it was interesting just as an observation, you know, with regard to the post-Madoff world. After that occurred, there were a lot of Ponzi scheme cases, for example, that we worked on. And I think a lot of it was fallout from Madoff that, you know, people, investors, unfortunately, who were being victimized by Ponzi schemes started to ask more questions of the promoters of these schemes and maybe were asking, you know, to get their money out. And that exposed a lot more Ponzi schemes. So depending on what was, you know, going on, you know, at that moment in time, you know, in the country with regard to the, you know, markets and whatever, you know, schemes were going on, I think sometimes did affect the types of cases that we would be investigating. So that's one example of, you know, we had a plethora of, you know, Ponzi schemes at in you know, 2008 and 2009 and, you know, after the Madoff case.
Right. So are we missing anything big?
Missing anything big.
Or small?
Or small. Yeah, I mean, I think that you covered, you know, for the most part, the highlights, at least, of, you know, at least my tenure at the SEC. You know, I will say that the creation of the Municipal Securities and Public Pensions Unit for me was really an extraordinary opportunity. You know, when I set out to create the unit, I really wanted to pursue cases that would impact market behavior. I thought that was, you know, an important point to be made with regard to the unit, given the underregulated nature of municipal securities, given the highly retail nature of the investor base, that, you know, in order to have an impact out there in the market, you know, you want to bring cases as an enforcement lawyer that will cause people to take notice and to hopefully change their behavior for the good. So, you know, for example, you know, you bring cases against, you know, a state like the state of New Jersey or the state of Illinois, hopefully the message that they will send will be to other states or other municipalities to take notice, because they don't want to be the next one to be sued by the SEC. And all of that will hopefully serve as a deterrent to them, which in my view would be beneficial, obviously, to investors, because what it, for the most part, will require is an enhancement of the disclosure. I mean, the SEC is a disclosure-based agency. So, you know, many times if, you know, an issuer of municipal securities, for example, discloses all material information, you know, the good, the bad, you know, that will typically satisfy the SEC in terms of assuring the SEC that there's no omission of a material fact or there's no misrepresentation of material fact. So that is part of the effort. You know, when you're in enforcement, you bring these cases, you want to have a high impact on the market, you want to try to affect market behavior. And I believe that that's, you know, what I attempted to and hopefully did achieve as the inaugural chief of that unit.
So tell me then a little bit about leaving the SEC after 25 years, more
yes.
than.
Yes, after 25 years, it was, I determined to look for other opportunities in private practice. I had never been in private practice, never worked at a law firm or any other place but the SEC. And I thought after 25 years, you know, it was time to hand the reins over to my successors to, you know, continue with the Municipal Securities Unit, which they've done admirably since I've left, as well as, you know, to be in charge of the Philadelphia Office Enforcement Program. So, you know, here I am at ORIC, which I started last September as a partner. And it's just a tremendous opportunity, you know, for me to, you know, see things from the other side and to, you know, help clients both achieve, you know, compliance with the securities laws and, you know, assist them, you know, in any sort of, you know, regulatory, you know, cases that might come their way to help defend them. And so I think that it's, you know, for me, you know, important for me to be able to be on the other side. As a lawyer, you know, you do look at problems and from all different angles. And, you know, in some respects, it's really just looking at the other side of the same coin, mm-hmm. Able to argue, you know, the other side as opposed to being the prosecutor. So it's been a rewarding experience for me being here in private practice. Obviously, you know, being at the SEC for 25 years was a tremendous opportunity for me, and I was fortunate to, you know, have been involved in bringing some great cases, which I believe, you know, served to impact the market in a positive way. And I'm sort of looking forward to this next phase of my career continuing.
Are municipal securities a focus of your practice here? Or?
It so far it has been.
Yeah.
But of course, my practice is you know broader than that because I did you know continue to bring all sorts of you know enforcement actions up until you know the end at the end of my tenure at the SEC. But the municipal securities area has been keeping me quite busy. My former unit has been very active in pursuing various muni matters, and so that has been keeping me quite busy so far.
Now, legally, it's a very interesting time in the area, I suppose.
It is indeed. It is indeed.
All right. Well, if there's nothing else, that seems like a good place to wrap up.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be part of this, and you know, the development of municipal securities regulation is one that is continuing and will continue, and I think there's still you know many more things to come, and it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next several years.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.